Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. As technology progresses, how we deliver education across the globe may transform as well. How will more access to education open doors for economic opportunity? Hear more at morganstanley.com/economicengine. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. So it's been yet another insane week in the world of politics, and it's only Tuesday when we're recording this. Tuesday? Really? Feels like at least Thursday, maybe Friday. In any event, our main topic this week is going to be the big bank regulatory relief bill that's poised to pass the Senate and head over to the House. But first, a quick update on the race to succeed Gary Cohn as President Trump's National Economic Council director. A number of names floated up and down in the last few days until an early favorite returned, friend of the podcast, Larry Kudlow, a longtime economic commentator and CNBC host who served at the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan years. Trump is now close to naming Kudlow to the post. In fact, by the time you listen to this, he may have already made the call. This is going to come as a really big relief to Wall Street, who feared that a pro-tariff, pro-protectionist voice would take over for Cohn. And Kudlow is clearly not that, as he explained on his visit to Politico Money last fall.
And I also give Clinton a lot of credit for finishing Reagan's NAFTA. See, free trade is a big pro-growth thing in our model. And cutting the investment tax rate, like capital gains, that's a big thing in our model.
Okay, so now on to the banking bill, which is quite sexily known as S-2155, or the Economic Growth, Regulatory Relief, and Consumer Protection Act. Really rolls off the tongue. Now, this is a bill that's been in the works for some time. It was put together by Senate Banking Committee Chair Mike Crapo of Idaho, Republican, but that passed out of committee with significant bipartisan support. Here's Crapo talking about his bill.
The primary purpose of this legislation is to make targeted changes to simplify and improve the regulatory regime for community banks, credit unions, mid-sized banks, and regional banks to promote economic growth.
So the bill has got around a dozen Democratic co-sponsors, including Democrats who are up this year in red states that President Trump won. That's people like Joe Donnelly of Indiana and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. It's expected to pass the Senate easily and then move on to the House and probably to President Trump's desk sometime later this year. But progressive Wall Street reformers and some Democrats in Congress, led by Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, are trying to pump the brakes hard. They say this is a stealth effort to deregulate banks and will hurt consumers and pave the way for the next financial crisis.
I don't understand how anybody in the United States Senate votes for a bill that's going to increase the likelihood of taxpayer bailouts. I think that we do better as a country and we do better as a Congress when we're there to fight for working people and not for Wall Street banks.
So who's right here? The main thing this bill would do is reduce some regulatory burdens on medium-sized banks, those that have assets in the range of $50 billion to $250 billion. This is more regional banks like SunTrust and others, not the big names you think of as Wall Street like JP Morgan or Citigroup. The idea behind this is to get some of the more onerous regulations off of the more medium-sized banks that don't do all the stuff that Wall Street does. And even some of Dodd-Frank's authors, including former Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, said that the initial $50 billion threshold was too low. He's in favor of raising it, even though he has some disagreements with what's in the Crapo bill. It would do some other stuff, too. It would ease requirements on smaller community banks and credit unions, though even here, critics of the bill warn that it might encourage banks to make riskier mortgages. And they even say that eased reporting requirements for some of these smaller banks could make it easier for lenders to discriminate when making loan decisions. There's also fear out there that an aspect of this bill will allow the U.S. subsidiaries of global banks to escape regulation in the United States. That's something that a lot of progressive Wall Street reformers are pointing to. They say that big global banks will get relief under this bill in their U.S. subsidiaries and could get up to no good in activities that maybe led to the financial crisis in the first place. So I tried to unpack some of these claims on both sides on this bill and get to the bottom of what it would really do and whether you should be worried about it. We talked to a couple of major expert analysts in the field who've covered this thing from inception to today. All right, we're joined by Isaac Boltanski. He's director of policy research at Compass Point, covers regulation and policy as it impacts financial stocks. Isaac, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Isaac, this is billed as the biggest change in bank regulatory reform since the Dodd-Frank law was passed. Some Democrats led by Elizabeth Warren say this is a nightmare, this is going to lead us to the next financial crisis. But Republicans and a lot of moderate Democrats say no, this is actually perfectly reasonable reforms tailored to mid-sized, smaller banks and fixes some things that were just wrong with Dodd-Frank. So tell us from the 30,000-foot level, what exactly would this CRAPO bank regulatory relief bill do?
Sure. I think that there are really two main ways to bucket the provisions in this bill, and it's controversial and not. And on the controversial side, I think the main thing that we should focus on is that it moves the $50 billion bank buffer up to $100 billion immediately, and then after 18 months, up to $250 billion. And that's meaningful for the affected banks because it will significantly lessen their compliant costs. At the simplest level, this bill provides regulatory relief for the nation's smallest banks and its regional banks. It's not perfect by any means, and there are surely areas of honest disagreement over policy when it comes to some of the more acute issues, some of which do touch the largest banks in the country. But the vast majority of this bill is going to benefit the nation's smallest banks and the nation's regional banks, which in turn is not going to have any material impact on financial stability in this, of the system.
I want to go back to the big kind of headline provision that everybody focuses on, and that is making the regulatory burden lighter on banks with assets between $50 billion and $250 billion. And there are authors of Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank himself, who said this $50 billion threshold for assets to apply all of these increased regulatory burdens was too low and it should be raised. Then you have now some progressive Democrats like Senator Elizabeth Warren saying, wait a minute, this bill will unleash a new financial crisis. We shouldn't be lessening the regulatory burdens on bigger banks. So talk to me about the banks we're talking about that are in this area between $50 billion in assets and $250 billion in assets. These are relatively large banks, but they're not the huge ones like JP Morgan and Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. But there are big banks in here. Which banks are going to benefit from this change in who gets the heavier regulation?
I think the big picture to think about here is it's a tailoring of the existing regulatory regime rather than the removal. And the way that I describe it to clients is, look, the proponents of this bill say that it's going to unleash the new wave of lending and economic growth. The opponents say that it's going to produce some sort of Mad Max-like hellscape of predatory misdeeds. Obviously, the reality is far more nuanced. My take with this bill on balance, and in particular, the $50 billion threshold moving upward to $250 billion, is that it's a narrow, modest fix that in many ways should right-size the existing regulatory regime.
Okay, so again, which banks are we talking about here? Is this like the SunTrusts of the world, the big mega regionals that are kind of in this window between $50 billion and $250 billion? Like which banks benefit from this?
Sure. So the way to think about it is initially, right away, the banks that will benefit are those between $50 billion and $100 billion assets. So there you should think of CIT Group, Zions, Comerica, and Discover. Then in the next iteration, you want to focus on banks that are between $100 billion and $250 billion in assets. And then starting at the lower end there in that bucket, it's M&T, Huntington, Northern Trust, KeyCorp, Fifth Third. American Express. So here we're really talking about super regionals and regional banks that will benefit, not the money center or universal banks like JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America.
Okay, so when somebody like Senator Warren says we're paving the path to the next financial crisis, I mean, most people think about the financial crisis. They think about the failure of Lehman Brothers. They think about Bear Stearns. They think about then Citigroup and other big banks that really caused the crisis in 2008, 2009. The names you just mentioned really aren't in there. So is she just wrong when she says that this is likely to lead us to the next financial crisis? Or if you had some combination of all of these sort of mid-sized or regional banks collapsing at the same time, then you could have a new financial crisis. So who's right and who's wrong here?
Yeah, look, I think that the inherent complexity of financial regulation lends itself to hyperbole on both sides. My view of this bill is that it is unfair to say that this is going to lead to another financial crisis, because it is narrowly targeted on regional and super regional banks who have far simpler business lines. Furthermore, let's not lose the forest for the trees. The banking sector is far healthier today than it has ever been before. And I think that that is a testament to the to the Dodd-Frank Act and the regulatory focus that came from that law. And so really, if anything, I would argue that this bill ensures that the skeletal framework of the Dodd-Frank Act survives, while also just resizing some of the law's muscle. So I think that a lot of the rhetoric from the Hill has been politically driven rather than policy driven. And that makes sense given the environment that we're in.
Right. And you mentioned the idea that this is not getting rid of Dodd-Frank, and far from it, really. The CFPB stays. Lots of provisions of Dodd-Frank stay in effect for the nation's largest banks, which has led to a significant amount of Democratic support for this bill. We're expecting it to clear the Senate this week with as much as a dozen, perhaps more, Democrats voting in favor of it. Talk about the way in which this gets to a fissure in the Democratic Party, that you have a lot of kind of more moderate Democrats, perhaps from red states, who are in favor of this, and then some of the hard left-wing Democrats very opposed to this. This is showing us a little bit of the internal dynamics of the Democratic Party right now.
Yeah, I think that there are two points to make in response to that. The first is that this bill, the CRAPO bill, is the natural reaction to the implementation of what was a very complicated law in 2010. And so it took time for the regulators to actually write the rules, to then see what the rules' impacts were on the market, and then to find the lowest common denominator from a legislative perspective that could actually pass. And so the first point is this bill is the product of 8 years of looking at what the law has done and talking about what the appropriate policy reaction should be. The second point is a bit more political. And the reality is there are a number of Senate Democrats in tough races. As we know, there are 26 Democrats up for Democratic seats up for reelection this cycle. 10 of those are in states that President Trump won. And President Trump won those by an average of 14 points. So I think that there are some moderate Democrats who are eager to show a capacity to legislate on a bipartisan basis and to work with Republican counterparts, which should help in some of the key states here where we are tracking, for example, Senator Tester from Montana, Senator Heidkamp, Senator Donnelly, all of whom are leaders on this bill and up for re-election.
Okay, I want to throw a Twitter question at you. This is from at Brian Gowan, and it's a topic that's come up among Democrats who are opposed to the bill, and I'm not really clear on how this bill would impact this. But he asks, how is the treatment of foreign banks operating in the U.S. going to be different than U.S. banks? So there's some controversy out there that this will somehow give foreign banks operating in the U.S. Less regulation and in some way perhaps an advantage over their domestic competitors. And even inside the administration, there have been different comments from members of the administration on what this would do. Tell us about how things would change for foreign banks operating in the U.S. under this bill.
Yeah, I think that when we look at the landscape of Democratic opposition, the attack that has garnered the strongest support has been the claim that this bill would dramatically reduce the regulatory regime for foreign banks with domestic subsidiaries. I think that that attack, however, was blunted in two ways. First, Chairman Powell was specifically asked about this during his hearing and said emphatically that the Federal Reserve, which has direct oversight, will remain the cop on the beat there and to not worry. And secondly, we've seen actual legislative language put into the substitute amendment that addresses this particular question. So I think it was a sly and expedient way of handling this charge when Chairman Crapo decided to add the language saying that foreign banks over $100 billion still will have the same degree of regulatory responsibility. Look, ultimately, as with anything, laws have to be maintained by the regulatory agencies with authority. So it's still a question of what the Fed will do once it actually takes the pen here from Congress. But my sense is that the main point of opposition among Democrats to this bill, which is its treatment of foreign banks with domestic subsidiaries, has been largely blunted by Chairman Powell and by Chairman Crapo.
Very good. We'll let that be the last word. Isaac Botanski, thank you so much for joining us and explaining this very complicated topic.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Banking Bill Bonanza, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A message from Morgan Stanley. As technology continues to advance, how we deliver education across the globe may transform as well. How will more access to education open doors for economic opportunity? As more investors look for these types of inclusive growth and sustainable investing opportunities, will sustainable investing just become investing? Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/economicengine. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
We're joined by Jarrett Seaberg. He's the Financial Services and Housing Policy Analyst for Cowen Washington Research Group. Jarrett, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. So this debate on this big bank regulatory relief bill is going on as we speak. Jarrett was telling me he's in the midst of his second or third cup of coffee as he's watching the Senate move forward on this thing. The first big picture question I have for you is, what are the major things that this bill would do? Obviously, this is the first big crack that Congress is taking at altering the Dodd-Frank financial regulatory reform law. What are the top line things that this bill would accomplish?
Okay, not to be the Debbie Downer in this conversation, but this bill actually does far less than it's perceived to accomplish. But it's far more important than the little that it does, because if you can actually get 16 or 17 Senate Democrats, a third of Senate Democrats, on board with changing Dodd-Frank, then that's a symbol that real deregulation can go forward at both the regulatory level, and it also opens the door for Congress to start moving additional legislation in the next couple of years. So from a symbolic standpoint, this bill far exceeds the actual text.
Okay, so if what you're telling me is this is much more of a symbolic bill than it is a massive rollback of Dodd-Frank or change in the existing way we regulate banks, then why is it that Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Sherrod Brown, some of the more progressive Democrats, are out there, you know, banging their gavels and banging their fists on the table saying, you know, this is going to lead us into the next financial crisis and this is a massive deregulation of Wall Street, if it really doesn't seem like it is that in the legislation? Why are they saying that and are they wrong?
So I think they're saying this because they're worried about what could come next. That if you can get a broad bipartisan majority for this bill, then it would suggest that we could slowly start chipping away at the many other rules and regulations, particularly those focused on the largest banks. So, you know, from our perspective, that's really why the Democrats are fighting so hard.
Got it. Now, there's also criticism that the bill, a late amendment to the bill, would essentially give a boost to credit reporting agencies like Equifax, requiring, I believe, that mortgage lenders look at something beyond FICO when they're making their assessment of credit worthiness for mortgages in a way that would benefit somebody like Equifax. Obviously, Equifax has been in the news and been beat up badly for their terrible security breach. Do you think it's fair, this criticism, that this is somehow a weird boon to somebody like Equifax, who's not exactly been a good actor of late?
So it's a really interesting way to attack the bill, because one thing that we have heard from housing advocates, which tend to be overwhelmingly progressive Democrats, is that Fannie and Freddie are far too tied to the traditional FICO score, that they need to look at alternative measures of credit worthiness. And this has really been a long-term objective for the affordable housing, expanded mortgage lending coalitions that are out there. As it got included in this bill, and progressives are looking for a reason to attack this measure, it has become just a convenient way to say, oh my gosh, we can't do this. This will help these companies. The reality is that was never the primary focus of it. It wasn't focused on those companies. It was focused on mortgage lending. And so I think that's a little bit of a red herring. The more interesting attack to me on the Equifax and TransUnions of the world is if you look at the provision that was put in there requiring free credit reporting for members of the military, that does include a prohibition on the enforcement of the provision through class action liability. The credit bureaus, it's very difficult to publicly oppose anything, that would benefit members of the military. But I do think the credit bureaus are quite worried that this free credit monitoring could expand to all consumers, which would go after a source of revenue for these companies. But I think they had to accept this military provision. But the fact that they could include class action protection in there does take some of the sting away. I'm a little surprised that hasn't gotten more attention. And given that, we still have some more time before they finally vote, I would expect some floor speeches on that.
Got it. Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us. We'll let you go back to watching the super exciting process of this bill play out in the United States Senate. Thanks again.
Cup of coffee number 4 is already poured and ready to be drunk.
Enjoy it, sir. Thank you. Okay, so that's it for our explainer of the banking bill currently moving forward in the Senate. The Politico money takeaway from this is that some of the sky is falling rhetoric from Warren and other people on the left is pretty much overblown. This is mostly, as we heard, a pretty incremental rollback of some provisions of Dodd-Frank that maybe weren't the greatest idea in the first place. This is not a massive giveaway to Wall Street or a rolling back of all of the safeguards that were put in place after the crisis. But Jarrett's point that Democrats fear that this could be the tip of the spear for further total Dodd-Frank repeal and rollback, well, that seems more legitimate and more of a reason that Democrats might want to oppose this thing. If this is just the first in a series of steps to roll back Dodd-Frank, then that's something worth worrying about. It also seems like a lot will be left up to regulators, particularly at the Fed, to make sure global banks don't get off easy on U.S. regulation. And the concerns about potential abuses in the mortgage space by smaller lenders also seem like it should get some significant attention when the bill moves to the House. So there are some issues here for sure that need to be looked at and addressed further before this thing gets signed into law by the president, but it also doesn't seem like this is the end of the world and the return of freewheeling Wall Street ways that crash the global economy. All right, that's all for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producers, Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez, and our executive producer, Dave Shaw. you're enjoying the show, please sign up on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. And remember, rate us and write a written review, and we'll be back with you next week.